Welcome to New Books in Environmental Studies. I'm your host, Jen Huntley, and today I'm talking to Char Miller about his new book, Public Lands, Public Debates, A Century of Controversy, out this year with the Oregon State University Press. Director of the Environmental Analysis Program and W.M. Keck Professor of Environmental Analysis at Pomona College, Char Miller has built a career around the study of public land management philosophy and practice. He has written and edited numerous books, including Gifford Pinchot and the Making of Modern Environmentalism, Water in the 21st Century West, a High Country News Reader, and Cities and Nature, Urban Environments in the American West. Miller explicitly designed the essays in Public Lands, Public Debates to appeal to a wide audience, and given the power of public lands controversies to engage Americans across class, regional, and political realms in deep discourse, I'm sure this book will strike a chord with many. I thoroughly enjoyed reading Miller's provocative and engaging essays, and I know you will too. Please enjoy this interview with Char Miller. Today we're going to be talking to Char Miller, who is the author of the very recently published Public Lands, Public Debates, A Century of Controversy, just out this year with the Oregon State University Press. I've read this book. It does a fantastic job of capturing the range of debates about public lands in a dynamic and accessible format. It's a series of short essay vignettes, each focusing on a particular historic episode in public lands debates that sheds light on various aspects of controversy in the United States. So, Char, thank you very much. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jen, so much. I'm glad to be here. This will be fun.
It is. It's great. So, first of all, I'd like you to say a few words about yourself. Like, where were you born? Where did you go to school? How did you get interested in environmental history and public lands? Things like that.
Well, I wish I could say I had an epiphany at some point in my life that led me to environmental history, but unfortunately, it's a longer and more obscure process, I think, in my case. I grew up in Connecticut and went to high school there and ultimately came west for college at Pitzer College in Claremont, California, where I'm now teaching at its sister institution, Pomona College. And even though I was living here and studying with people who were working on environmental issues, actually my interests at that time were much more intellectual and cultural. So I was very interested, for example, ironically, in Gifford Pinchot, who ultimately I would write a book about, but I didn't really think about his work as a conservationist. I was really interested in his life and others like him who were reformers and was puzzled by the reformist impulse. Why did people want to change the world? I hadn't yet focused on why people changed the landscape. I was more interested in sort of the political and social side of these issues. So I went off to graduate school at Johns Hopkins in American history, studied with Kenneth Lynn, who was a brilliant literary and intellectual historian. And while talking with him about what I wanted to do for my dissertation, realized I really actually had a different story to look at. And so the first book ultimately was called Fathers and Sons, The Bingham Family and the American Mission, which looked at this five generation of a family, all males, all fathers and sons, interacting with one another as they all became reformers of one kind or another, was trying to look at that question of why did someone want to change the world? What was motivating them to do so? When I finished that, I realized I had that was great, and that might actually get me tenure, which was good. By this time, I was teaching at Trinity University in San Antonio, where I was happily teaching for the next 20-something years or so. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of casting around for another thing, and I had written a paper about Pinchot when I was in graduate school, but I hadn't done anything beyond that. And I suddenly, in the midst of the Reagan administration, I realized, wait a second, there's a Republican administration who really hates environmental issues, or really hates environmentalists in a sense. And I've actually studied people who were Republicans 80 years ago who thought very differently. So maybe there's a story here.
Right.
So the Pinchot biography, which ultimately took 15 years to write, really was sparked or re-sparked by that issue. And I have to give Gifford Pinchot credit for changing my life and career. Because once I started to write about him, I realized that I was asking the wrong questions, or that there were better questions or different questions to ask, which was not why did he become the conservationist, although the book does talk about that. It's really, what did conservation mean in America? What did it mean to say that some lands needed to be set aside and protected and preserved in one set of ways, and other lands we could, you know, beat up as cities or industrialize or whatever? And so, you know, he gave me that question. And
yeah.
So I'm deeply grateful for him. And as I know for you, having written about Yosemite and the folks who were there, suddenly your subjects are starting to define what it was you thought you were going to do.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And that clearly comes through in this book, in the Public Lands, Public Debates book, that you are still grappling with that question on a different level or different dimensions.
Yeah,
of
I think
that
that's right. And you know, in a way, what the Pinchot biography taught me in a hard way was that it was hard to figure out where I stood relative to the subject I was writing about.
Right.
I didn't know narratively where to locate myself. And that was hard because I sort of went into the project thinking, well, Pinchot, you know, he might be a good foil for Reagan, but I'm still a Muirite. So how do I deal with that? And, you know, that's sort of an interesting problem in its own right. But in the end, what helped me understand that subject, and then, as you say, sort of continue to play it out in the new book, was that it didn't really matter where I was. That really the issue was trying to figure out how to talk to a professional audience, but also a broader public, about these issues that I think matter to all of us, but we don't always give credit to them. And
right.
So this new book, as you've suggested, is really another attempt at getting at the same kinds of issues about why the environment matters, why situating ourselves in natural systems and being conscious about that is really important. But the other piece to the book was that I wanted to speak to my sisters, to my family, to people who I knew would not read just another monograph. I mean, they might because I wrote it, but
right.
Probably, you know, they'd skim it and say, yeah, interesting book, Charles.
Yeah, nice job.
Nice. Thanks a lot for sharing. And what I really wanted to do was to sort of engage them where they were, which is in busy lives that required them to do lots of different things, and picking up a heavy tome may not be one of them.
Okay, so.
Yeah, so.
So that's how
that's
you.
That's what I was trying to do.
So is that how you came to the structure of creating these little vignettes. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's another piece of awkwardness because, you know, we're all trained as professionals to write, you know, 20 to 30 page articles with deep footnotes and all
right.
of that. And it was like, I've done that. I don't actually have to do that in the same way, but still convey the storyline
right.
and still sort of transmit the history. And as you know from teaching, that's part of what we do. We don't load it up with all of the scholarship up front. It's
sure.
embedded in how we lecture and talk and discuss. So I thought, well, okay, I've been teaching for almost, well, in this case now 30 years. Why not try that bit?
Okay.
And so as a way of thinking about it, I actually talked to myself about, okay, so instead of, as you're thinking about this, who are you going to dedicate the book to? Which is kind of weird.
Mm-hmm.
But I decided I would dedicate it to the students that I have studied with happily for the last 31 years at Trinity University in San Antonio and Pomona College now in Claremont, because they've really been the source of a lot of how I think about teaching, which, as it turns out, is a lot like I'm now thinking about writing.
Right.
And
yeah.
So that's been really exciting for me.
Oh, that's great.
You know, like these are almost like 50-minute lectures.
Right.
You know, they're short, they're compact, they get their points across, I hope.
Yeah.
And I hope also that it was exciting for me to write these things. And so I hope it's exciting for people to read them.
That's fantastic. Well, you've divided your book into four sections, and each section is it contains some of these 50-minute lectures as you're talking about, although I would guess that they're actually less than that. More like 20-minute TED Talks.
Yes, that's right. There you go.
And what I was thinking about is, would you be interested in talking a little bit about each one of these sections as a whole, and then
Sure.
pick your favorite episode out to kind of go into a little bit more detail and tell us about how that episode, as you see it, illustrates this larger point that you're getting at. So we
Good,
could
I'd love
start.
to.
Yeah, let's start with creative forces. What are you thinking
Yeah.
about in that section?
Well, part of the question is frame the part of the book is framed around not just that we have public lands, but why do we have public lands? What's their purpose and how did that happen? And who defined those purposes that are still controversial to us, such that the current candidates in the GOP presidential campaign are lambasting the fact that we have these public lands as they make their tours through the West. So something's going on.
Right.
We have them, but we're not easy with them, or at least some people are not easy with them. So I wanted to sort of write a series of pieces that looked at who came up with these ideas, what their lives were like, what they were thinking of as they were doing it in the late 19th century, and why then? Why that time did some Americans decide that some lands ought to be set aside so that we could better regulate the use of natural resources? And as I've talked with my students, and now probably bored them endlessly, this generation of the late 19th and early 20th century were really remarkable people. And in some ways, their ambitions and their dreams and their fantasies are the worlds we live in now, that they really invented the world we inhabit. And so, thinking about people like Pinchot, to be sure, but even earlier than he, people like George Perkins Marsh and Nathaniel Eggleston and Albert Potter and other folks that most people don't know much about.
Right.
Turns out they're very creative souls, and they were trying to wrestle with an industrial revolution that seemed to them to be going too hard, too fast, and was obliterating things that they loved. And so they sort of stepped in and created a political consensus that some of those places would be protected, ultimately as national parks, in some cases as national forests, ultimately also as well as national refuges, a whole set of institutions that never existed prior to this generation's thinking that they ought to. And that's pretty amazing. But the story that within this that I'm really intrigued by is the way in which those past thoughts still inflect present actions. And so one of the pieces in here is a piece called Rough Terrain, Forest Management and Its Discontents. And it looks at the pushback against these ideas. That is to say, those who thought that George Perkins Marsh and George Bird Grinnell and Gifford Pinchot and Teddy Roosevelt and Mabel Osgood Wright and others who were really battling for birds and landscapes and trees and all these other kinds of things, that they were wrong. And so, you have to give the opposition credit. And so this piece actually starts off in the contemporary world, in which Earth First firebombed, Earth Liberation Front, I should say, Earth Liberation Front firebombed a series of buildings in Oregon and Seattle, and ultimately the one I'm describing is at the University of Washington. And I was struck when it happened in May of 2001 that what I was looking at was actually a tradition of violence and nonviolent reaction against the imposition of a scientific management of landscapes, and the politics that came from that. And so, although the wise youth movement of the 1980s and 90s would never see themselves in relationship to the Earth Liberation Front, I actually think they're linked in an intellectual way, that they don't like the system as it is, and they're going to push back by whatever means is possible. And in some cases, with the wise youth movement, blowing up ranger stations and putting bombs under a ranger's car. I don't think that is much different from blowing up a lab in which genetically modified material is being assessed and researched. So there was that piece to it that really struck me as quite interesting. And then there was this other side piece that was, I think, important that we often forget about politics. You actually need the edge. You need the periphery. You need the far right and the far left to define the center.
Interesting.
And that it's important for us to remember that Martin Luther King needed Malcolm X.
Right.
Malcolm X needed Martin Luther King. I mean, this is sort
Exactly.
of tension that flows in that direction. And in the environmental world, it works similarly, because it's a way for the Sierra Club to say, well, we're not that, we're just this. And that actually gives them a larger credence, I think. And
sure.
So that's sort of the piece I was working on that I think is probably most engaging for me as the writer, thinking about it. But, you know, thinking like a conservationist, which is the title of another piece, is also intriguing, because how do we think?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if we say we're one thing, what does that actually mean?
Mm-hmm.
Particularly in terms of public lands. And that leads to the second section, which is a piece on policy schemes, as I've
right.
described them. And the question here is, once you've created something called a national forest, now what do you do?
Right.
How do you actually manage such an object? And who's going to do the managing? And on what basis? And so this contains a series of essays that look at a number of decisions, and then legal decisions that were framed around people who thought we ought to manage in certain ways, and got the legal right to do so. And then again, there's always the pushback.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks at, for example, the Antiquities Act, which gave the President of the United States unparalleled power to, through the Antiquities Act, to create national monuments without ever asking anybody, Congress, state
right.
legislatures, whoever. Just gives them an enormous amount of power. The Weeks Act, which came a few years later, granted the federal government the right for the first time to buy private land for conservation purposes. And so this really affected the East, where there was very little public land, and allowed the national forest to emerge in the East, in the Pisgah in North Carolina, in the White Mountain National Forest, the Green Mountain National Forest in New England, and places like that. But the piece I'm really, you know, I want to talk about is this story that I sort of knew, but didn't know very much about. And it was around, it occurred in 1911,
mm-hmm.
and it was a lawsuit that ultimately made its way up to the Supreme Court. And it's U.S. v. Grimon, which was decided in May of 1911. And Grimon, who is a person no one knows anything about, he
okay.
was a shepherd. He was operated in the Sierra. And decided one day, as did many shepherds at that time, that these national forests meant nothing to them. They'd always grazed there. They were going to continue to graze there. And the only problem is that this time he got caught. And the irony is that the guy who caught him is a guy by the name of William B. Greeley, who would in time become the third chief of the Forest Service. So Greeley catches this guy and says, "Where's your permit?" Because everybody had to have a permit for use on land. And Grimaud had to admit that he didn't have one. And that launched a legal battle that went through the federal court system. Ultimately, the Supreme Court argued that Grimaud did not have the right to graze, that regulations, in fact, mattered, and that the Forest Service, this fledgling institution in 1911, it was only 6 years old at that point, actually had the constitutional right to manage its land.
Mm.
That's a really important decision,
mm-hmm.
because it's one thing to say, let's have a national park or a national forest. It's another thing to say, inside those boundary lines, only certain things can happen, and I have the right to say so.
And the power to make those.
And the power.
Yeah,
right, right.
To enforce,
I mean,
that.
William B. Greeley could stop the guy and then say, by the way, you're going to jail.
Right.
Which is really important. But what's also interesting about these various court decisions, and there are others that came at the exact same period that was parallel with this, but I was writing it at the centennial. I wrote this in May of 2011. It raises this other issue that I think is also a kind of neat loop, in which Grimaud is trying to challenge the existence of a national forest. And what he actually ended up doing in the lawsuit bearing his name was to make sure that they long endured. So there's, you know, I mean, that's a good story, and it has a nice narrative arc, but it also is true in that respect, that,
right.
that these are ways in which we're starting to think about, if you challenge it, what does that actually mean? The more contemporary issues within this section also look at issues around, I've got a chapter called Reefer Madness,
mm-hmm.
that sort of looks at marijuana planting on the national forest, illegal, obviously,
mm-hmm.
And how that challenges those of us who consider ourselves environmentalists,
Right.
And how you attack a drug culture that has decided that the national forest really ought to be growing dope, and the consequences of that. So that, you know, it was a fun process to work my way through in terms of thinking about these various issues of that. And also finally, in a bigger sense, the last chapter in this section looks at the agency, the Forest Service in this case, and what its future might be. It's one thing to talk about its past. It's another to start to fantasize about its future. And I say this hesitantly as an historian who knows nothing about the future, to be sure. But I was interested in asking a sort of prospective question, which is, if the agency has functioned in the ways that it's functioned over the last 105 years or so, 106 years of its existence, what's it going to do in the second 100 years? And how might that look? And so that's a chapter that's highly speculative and raises questions about sort of potentially future orientations. Mm. And I raise it because the third segment, called Internal Tensions, raises questions about the possibility of a future for any agency, let alone a Forest Service, as it's been described in the rest of the book. And so these set of pieces actually come out of a segment between 2004 and 2009, when I did a lot of traveling, writing, mm-hmm. and talking about the Forest Service, in part because the agency was going through its centennial. And then just kept writing because the issue struck me as really kind of interesting. And so this internal tension section looks not at the outside, but at the inside, not at how people were critiquing the organization from Congress or from a nonprofit point of view or an environmentalist point of view, but actually what was going on internal to the agency, and the questions and tugs and pulls that were driving its own internal life in a way. And so the pieces look at a series of issues that have cropped up since 2004, 2005, and continue to ripple out in a new way, asking about how an agency can change its operations, alter its policymaking, transform its public relations. And so I sort of pop in and out of various conferences and the like to listen in on what was taking place. And the more intriguing of these, in some senses, is a chapter called Identity Crisis, mm-hmm. which in 2008, the Forest Service published a internal survey of its members, of its employees. And actually, that's part of what's going on. The other part of it is trying to figure out how to address internal concerns as an agency ages.
Right.
And like the rest of the United States, the Forest Service, like the Park Service, like BLM, is filled with baby boomers like me, mm-hmm. who are getting to the end of their professional careers. And the question is, how does the agency regenerate itself? Hmm. So you have to ask yourself questions like that. And so they hired an outside firm to come in and to sort of pose the questions and take the temperature of the organization to get a feel for what its future looks like by sort of gazing in a crystal ball about its present. You know, how are people feeling, and how are they changing? How are their lives changing in some fashion? And it turns out the changes are tough.
Right.
And that people are unsettled by what they're going through. Both young, middle-aged, and older employees are all sort of in this intergenerational cement mixer. and they all sort of vaguely think the past was a lot happier, though it wasn't, and I think the rest of the book demonstrates that.
Right.
Which tells you the power of nostalgia. But it also tells you that people are a little risk-averse, like they're not quite ready to step into some new future because they're sort of hungering for something that seems to have been more stable and consistent across time.
Right.
So, yeah, so it's kind of interesting. And all institutions go through this process, I think.
Sure.
And it struck me as just a very interesting moment in which an agency sort of checks in with itself and finds itself pretty troubled.
Hmm.
And then the final section is, for me, in many ways, where I think the work of environmentalism needs to go. And that's predicated in part on that's where I think I need to go. And so I'm going to bring along everybody else, which
right.
is pretty narcissistic, but okay.
Oh, well.
And it's really framed around the question of climate change and the global nature of that shift that we're already experiencing. And I, you know, 8 years ago, 9 years ago, I was just beginning to think about these issues. And I went to a trip to Ecuador, which was actually for fun, but it became, as it turns out, professionally, probably the most important thing I'd done in a long time. And we went out to a place called Tipotini Biodiversity Reserve out in the Amazon, eastern Ecuador. And I was simply blown away. As the essay, I hope, shows that I had never seen a forest quite like this. I didn't even know that it was a forest. None of the frames of reference that I thought I knew from the United States mattered at all in what I was looking at. The birds were completely different. The morpho butterflies just, you know, knocked me out.
Right.
The trees don't have tree rings. What does that mean? So I was sort of unglued in the process in what I think is a very helpful way and forced me to realize that all that I thought I knew was sort of overwhelmed. And I mean, the last line in a sense was that I had to go abroad to understand the wooded world next door, that it really forced me to think out globally about the force that I thought I understood, which is, as it turns out, I think I didn't understand. The piece that, you know, let me talk a little bit about was most transformative was going down to Brazil several years later and working with an organization called Rights and Resources and the U.S. Forest Service, both of whom sponsored this trip, which was to look at and to go along with global foresters from all over the planet in a thing called Megaflorestias. So I was at the 2008 one in Brazil and in the 2007 one in St. Petersburg in Russia. Mm. And the most fascinating thing is to listen to foresters from Indonesia and China, from the Congo, from Russia, from Europe, from North America, who are confronting globally the same kinds of issues, but are having to deal with them through very different political institutions.
Oh, interesting.
And so, you know, if you're thinking about China versus Canada versus Brazil, we're looking at political institutions that are so different, and yet they're all wrestling with, oh my God, you know, the climate is changing and the forest cover is going to change, and so how do we wrestle with environmental justice issues to make sure that people have an economic life that flows off of these forests, and yet also manage these landscapes in a ways that will allow them to endure across time so that we can have economic and environmental services that flow off of them. Hmm. And so the piece the last piece in the book is called Forestry Done Right. And it's looking at it uses as a case study, a piece of property, in Brazil, in the Amazon. And I've actually got on my desk a paperweight that they gave us. It's an organization called Precious Woods. It's a European-funded Forest Stewardship Council-certified landscape. And with my forester colleagues, we spent a day walking the lands of this organization and listening to the resident foresters talk to us about what they were doing and how they were intertwining forestry, a professional object of which is to cut trees for production, with social justice issues in terms of the workers who work for them and also the communities that revolve around them, and with this new concept of sustainability, which is to say, in a forestry notion, is that you do not clear cut, you don't bulldoze this stuff down, which is happening all around it.
Sure.
There's a better way, an easier way on the land to make this work. And it all sounds, you know, better than probably it actually is, and the piece has some concerns about that. But I was struck by what I was looking at was potentially a resolution for the intertwined questions of environmental management, environmental justice, and environmental economics, which is how can you make the landscape work for us and we for it? so that it is not destroyed. It is precious. It is maintained, all the while knowing that there are other places that we want to preserve so that they are, you know, the biological diversity is less disturbed. The air is cleaner. The water is better. I mean, that, how do we better understand public lands and the debates that wrap around them, whether in Brazil or the United States, Canada or China? What's the mechanism by which we do that?
Hmm.
And the book is an attempt to raise those questions. I don't answer them. I don't think they're unanswerable or inanswerable, but I do think my job was really to sort of start the conversation.
Right.
And so I hope it does.
Well, I think you raise a lot of really, you know, contemporary, of course, issues, like with this global warming, within a historical context, which is fantastic. I think you're absolutely right to say, you know, that there is a kind of nostalgia, clearly within the Forest Service Agency, but I think that's something that, you know, is carried around in the broader public too. And I think, I think that is going back to your very early point about how the similarities between the left and the right edges is that animus. There's an energy that seems to be fueled by this mythology of the past. So I really love the way that you link the present and the past together constantly in these discussions. I have a question for you.
Sure.
Your premise is that this is about public lands, but you are talking mostly about the Forest Service. And I'm just wondering how, to what degree do you see the Forest Service issues being characteristic of other land management agencies in America? And also, how are they different? Because there are episodes in the book where you draw those contrasts, like with the National Park Service in the 1930s and things like that. So can you talk a little more about that?
Yeah, I would love to. And I
Great.
I think that it's a really interesting dilemma for those of us like you who write about the National Park Service, which, you know, its landscapes are always embedded within national forests because that's where the land came from initially in some ways. And so all of a sudden you have two agencies, and in the case of BLM, and maybe Fish and Wildlife, and then state lands and county parks or whatever. I mean, if you start to look at the map of public lands as a flow chart, it's really complicated. And so on the one hand, I would say that any one of these entities, whether it's local, state, or federal, operates within a political landscape that is oftentimes confusing because it itself has overlapping authorities and boundary lines.
Hmm.
So part of the thing that I think all of us wrestle with when we write about the past or the present of these institutions is trying to sort through what the pressure points are, trying to figure out internal to each of these agencies what they are charged with doing, what's their mission, and how does that mission differ across the boundary lines, literal in a property sense, but also in a political sense, the lines that demarcate a national forest from a national park, from a national grassland, from a refuge, from a state park or something like that. And, you know, you got to pick your fights and you got to pick your focus. And mine's on the Forest Service, but it's one of the things I've learned in talking with National Park Service employees and BLM employees and the like is that there are resonances between their struggles and there are their distinctions. And the resonances are that, A, you work in effect for the American people. Your budget comes through Congress, which means there's all sorts of interest groups that can shape that budget regardless of what you would like to do. They would like you to do something else. And so I was in Alaska in the 2004 presidential campaign, and the rangers were telling me that they were getting phone calls direct, not through their forest supervisor, but direct from the congressional delegation of Alaska about what they could and couldn't say about anything to the public. Talk about pressure.
Right.
And, you know, I suspect that's true at BLM and NPS, NPS as well at different points. And it taught me something. I didn't know such things happened. I thought things were, you know, rational, and not outside the board. But so they'll tell you that those things happen. But there are so, as I say, distinguishing marks that make a national park not a national forest and a national forest not a national park. And it's embedded in their mission statements and in the congressional, demands on them for what they are to do. And as you know, the national park is really about the preservation of landscapes and mm-hmm. the telling of those lands' history through their preservation. And mm-hmm. so if you're at Yosemite or Death Valley or Arches or some other wonderful national park, the purpose is really to preserve the landform as best we're able to do mm-hmm. and open it for our exploration under certain guidelines and regulations, but it's not to mine, it isn't a gas drill, it isn't to do fracking.
Right.
It's not to clear cut. It's a very different process. And so part of what I tried to do in, for example, there's a piece called Placemaking, which looks at Devil's Postpile.
Right.
Which sometimes is in the Forest Service and sometimes is in the Park Service. And I thought, oh, this will be fun.
Yeah.
You know, and it turns out it's a Forest Service guy who stops the development of the river such that Devil's Postpile actually wouldn't get submerged. But in the end, it's really, and rightly, inside National Park Service now as one of its really fabulous places. And, you know, those are stories and complications that I hope people will pick up on, that when you step over one boundary line, you're stepping into a history.
Right.
You're stepping into a human articulation of what it is you should feel and think about in a particular space and use. So that part's really exciting for me, even though I don't write about it all the time. I'm alert to it in part because I think you have to be when you enter into a place that is functions in a different fashion.
That's a really good point. I don't know if this is relating to this or going off in a totally different direction. Another theme that came up as you were talking in my mind, just listening to you talk, is especially when you were dealing with kind of the origin of these institutions at the turn of the 19th century into the 20th,
yeah,
is the role of science in this whole discussion. Because, and especially when you bring in the Earth Liberation Front attack, because that is all about the fear that people have about science or the scientific experimentation, scientific inquiry and manipulation and this feeling of power. I mean, on one hand,
yes.
science is empowering. It empowers the progressives, right? It gives them this great tool to say, we are going to manage these resources scientifically as opposed to by free market principles. And on the other hand, it's disempowering. So people are saying, well, what happens when these genes get, you know, loose, you know, Franken plants, you know, running around in our genetic pool. So as you're going through this, what do you as a historian and somebody who's looking at these disputes, how do you see science running through these stories?
Well, I love the question, and I wish I had had this question a year and a half ago, so I could better weave it more explicitly through
next
there.
But book.
I think you've that's the next book. But I think you've actually touched on something that's so crucial in contemporary popular culture, but which I think, as you also know, you roll back to the late 19th century, and science was perceived of as this liberating object. And as it turns out, it was a language that Pinchot, who was trained in forestry, was happy to use to make a political case for why national forests ought to exist. And it turns out that the Antiquities Act, which has been a huge benefit to the National Park Service, also makes the same claim about science, in this case, archaeology, as a science, in a sense,
right,
that would lead to preservation. And so whether you preserve or you regulate and thus utilize in the ways that Pinchot was imagining, both are drawing off of this new scientific tradition that says there is this person who knows science, let's call him an expert, because it's mostly hymns at that point.
Right.
And this expert knows things that non-experts don't know, and that gives them the right, in a sense, politically, at least to make the case that their position ought to be heard and maybe even accepted writ large. In Pinchot's calculation, some of this, and Greeley, who would follow him, who was the third chief of the Forest Service following this, made these cases that, look, science has its way of helping unlock some of the secrets of nature and how it operates. But it turns out it also allows us to better regulate its uses.
Mm-hmm.
And so Pinchot would argue in a variety of contexts, in, you know, publicly and in letters and the like, that, look, the real thing about conservation is we're not managing the land, we're managing the people. And that strikes me, as you have suggested, in two ways, one of which is he's not wrong. Human
right.
behavior is actually the issue. And he is wrong in the sense of then you're now we're dealing with sort of democratic pressures, which is why the public debates part of the title of my book
right.
is in there. This is not just about the land. It's about the debates over the land and who manages it and under what conditions. And science has played, as you say, this really interesting role that at times is at the exact same moment it is beneficial, it can be a deficit.
Well, and I, you know, this is me kind of, you know, coming in with my own opinion here, but I really think that this question about science, there's a kind of dark side to the scientists
sure.
of the turn of the century that is, look, we have this expertise that allows us to transcend the democratic process. And I think that there's an attempt at various points in time over our history for scientists to say, this is indisputable. You know, it's science. And yet, as you point out in some of the mismanagement of fire, you know, fire suppression.
Right.
And,
right.
you know, that what is best science in 1910 is, it turns out in, you know, 1999 to be a very bad idea.
Right.
So
right.
And now, you know, and now we're faced with this climate change, as you, you know, very, very relevantly wrap your book up around. And again, scientists are befuddled by why is it that people are not,
yeah.
you know, accepting this idea. And I think that the history that you lay out, if it's not necessarily explicit in a lot of your stories, it still points to that dynamic
yeah.
as well.
Yeah, which that's
is,
fair.
Yeah. One of the things I really enjoy about reading this book and thinking about. So it is very, I think you were very successful at raising some excellent questions that are going to.
Oh, thank you.
that are going to.
I love that.
Yeah. And hopefully keep those debates and those controversies going. So.
Well, and I think that's part of it is that in the end, that there's a line in there somewhere about, you know, I know, it's sort of the pull quote on the book is watching democracy at work can be bewildering, even frustrating, but the only way individuals and organizations can sift through the often messy business of public deliberation is to deliberate.
Yes, exactly.
We can't hide,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, if
mm-hmm.
we really think this is important, let's start and stop with climate change. If we're really going to do it, then get into the public arena and talk about it. And
right.
don't, you know, just assume people should accept it and don't just assume that the scientists are wrong.
Right.
But actually have a real conversation, and that's not something we're real able to do.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, Char, we've taken up a lot of your time. And I really, really want to thank you for being on the show today. The excitement in your voice about this project just is really great. And I think this is going to be a fantastic contribution to these ongoing discussions. I was wondering if you could take a few minutes
sure.
to tell us about what your next project is.
Well, there's a couple of projects that are underway, and one of them is looking at the 50th anniversary of the Pinchot Institute for Conservation, of which I'm a senior fellow. And we were kicking around this idea over the summer that, you know, we actually have this 50th anniversary. Maybe it's time to reflect on what's actually happened. And so what I'm doing is using the last 50 years of this organization as a way to start to look more closely at, again, issues of the public discourse about environmentalism. And as it turns out, and I've sort of been digging through their archives, it's, you know, it starts in 1963, immediately after Rachel Carson's book. Mm-hmm. And Kennedy came, in fact, to Gray Towers, Pinchot's home, to dedicate this, but months before he was assassinated. Mm-hmm. So we've got this really tumultuous moment, and it seemed like this thing was going to take off, and then it died. Mm-hmm. And it took about 10 to 15 years to revive it, and it went through various iterations. And so looking, tracking at those iterations is actually a way to help us understand some of the dilemmas that environmentalism as an idea and environmentalists as activists were encountering between 1963 and the present day. There's a second collection of books, essays that I hope will come out in the next year that uses the idea of place as its origin. And if essays that I've been writing about New Orleans, San Antonio, the Southwest, California, become framed around questions of place and place making and how we know where we live. And it's a more personal book in some ways because it's about me thinking about these things and quite explicitly. And so in some cases, it's a bit of a memoir. In some cases, it's maybe more autobiographical than it should be. But it's me, the writer, trying to figure out, as I mentioned earlier, trying to figure out my stance. Who am I? Huh. And how do I know myself in the places in which I live? And well, so it's a really fun book for me to write anyway.
Well, those both sound like really fascinating books, and definitely look forward to those coming forward. And and again, I just want to thank you for being on the show, and I look forward to talking with you more about these things later.
Thank you so much, Jen. This is a lot of fun to talk with you. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks, Char. See you later.
See
Bye.
You well. Bye.
You've been listening to my interview with Char Miller about his fascinating book, Public Lands, Public Debates, A Century of Controversy, on New Books in Environmental Studies. Once again, I'm your host, Jen Huntley. I hope you'll join me for my next interview, which will be with Michael Stone, author of Smart by Nature, Schooling for Sustainability, published by the Center for Eco-Literacy. Thank you.